call to order. We're going to do a couple things out of order today. We're going to have some telephonic testimony on House Bill 3419, and we're asked to call at 9 o'clock for that. And then about 9:30, we're going to be calling Judge Pratt to testify telephonically on House Bill 3020. We'll open today's session with a hearing on House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 2969. Ms. Moore, if you could give us a rundown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2969 is a fix of an existing statute currently under Oregon law. We call it the firearm minimum. Oregon Revised Statutes 161-610 provides mandatory minimum sentences for persons convicted of using or threatening the use of a firearm during the commission of a felony. A first-time offender is subject to a five-year sentencing mandatory minimum. Second offense is 10 years, and so on. Recently, a flaw in the drafting has been discovered, and I believe Mr. Underhill is here to tell you about a case that he prosecuted where a judge, because there is an escape clause where a first-time offender can be given something less than the 60 months, then the second-time offender came through, and the judge did not feel the mandatory minimum applied. So,
okay, thank you. Mr. Underhill.
Good morning, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this issue.
If you just identify yourself for the record, please.
It's Rod Underhill. That's R-O-D, last of U-N-D-E-R-H-I-L-L. I'm a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County District Attorney's Office.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is give you a little bit of background, if I may, relative to a short summary of the facts of a situation, and then discuss the law, how it is written, and then the suggested change. There was an individual by the name of Terrence Hayes. Terrence Hayes was an admitted gang member and pimp of women relative to prostitution. He had a girlfriend at one point in the recent past, and in an effort, I believe, to convince her to continue to work for him, he found himself in a hotel room with her and with a handgun. At one point, he took his handgun, he put it to her head, he put a round in the chamber and cocked the handgun, all the while threatening her, as you might imagine, to continue to do things the way he saw them. Ultimately, Mr. Hayes was convicted of that crime. He pled guilty to unlawful use of a weapon with a firearm and received a sentence pursuant to 161-610 subsection 4A, but then the court moved over to subsection 5 for purposes of imposition of a sentence and gave him a probation sentence, which was a lawful sentence for Judge Wilson to have imposed at that time. Following that, and while still on probation for the crime that I've just summarized, Mr. Hayes found himself around midnight one night with two other associates of his, and they ran across an individual by the name of Robert Ford. Robert Ford and Mr. Hayes had a feud between the two of them, and Mr. Hayes pulled out a gun that was with him, and he shot at Mr. Ford approximately five times, striking Mr. Ford once, causing serious physical injury. Following a jury trial, Mr. Hayes was convicted of attempted murder with a firearm, assault in the first degree with a firearm, and other associated charges for this obviously very serious conduct. At sentencing in front of the court, circuit court, the issue of what the exposure, what the sentence for Mr. Hayes should be relative to this now, the state's view of things, this now second gun minimum situation. As a result, the parties briefed the matters, meaning we prepared memorandum, we supplied them to the court, and so a legislative history examination was done relative to this statute. Shall I go ahead and talk about what I perceive to be the fix?
Please.
Okay. What we found in looking at things was that there seemed to be some guidance, some support for a genuine belief that, in fact, Mr. Hayes was now subject to subsection 4B, the 10-year gun minimum, having now been convicted previously with respect to the girlfriend situation of a gun minimum sentence and having had Judge Wilson impose that gun minimum sentence. There is some language relative to the statutes dealing with punishment and imprisonment that I don't know if you want me to spend time detailing at this point, because it does get pretty detailed. But ultimately, the court regarding Mr. Hayes found that the legislation as it is currently written and the legislative history as it stands is less than completely clear about whether or not when a court first sentences a defendant under subsection 5, the opt-out provision, when they're first for their first offense, if a court sentences them under subsection 161, 610, 5, does that count as a first conviction for purposes of gun minimum, and are they exposed then to the 10-year gun minimum for the second conviction? The court was... again, it was less than completely clear from the court's version of things, and as a result, this court believed that she could not sentence him to the 10-year gun minimum, but instead could only sentence him to the 5-year gun minimum for this attempted murder assault in the first degree case. Again, I'm prepared to talk specifically about the language and the confusion, but I think the confusion can be rectified and clarified with the suggested added language, that added language being under subsection 4B, the only change would be some additional language added, which tells us that if an individual has been previously sentenced under subsection 4A, meaning the 5-year gun minimum was imposed, or subsection 5 of this section, and that's the added language, the or subsection 5 of this section, which would then allow a judge to impose a 10-year gun minimum even if they gave the defendant something less than 5 years the first time. Judge Beatty, clear back in 1979, testified for the House Judiciary Committee and was a proponent of this opt-out provision, and so it was added, and it seems to be a good addition to have for a first offender, in that the idea being maybe a first offender can be treated, maybe they can change their lifestyle and be an addition to the community. And so not every first-time offender deserves a 5-year sentence. However, when a person such as Mr. Hayes or somebody similarly situated does not take advantage of that situation, and, for example, while on probation, attempts to kill somebody, it seems that the court should have the ability to then impose that 10-year gun minimum as originally drafted. Would you like any additional information? Because, again, I don't want to take a...
I think you cover it pretty well. Are there any questions from the panel?
Mm-hmm.
Nope.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you
very much, then.
Close the public hearing and move to work session.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to move House Bill 2969 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
I'll carry that one. Move to the full committee with the due pass. Let me bring the 2457.
That's not, it's just a work session.
Okay. Okay, open a work session on House Bill 2457. Ms. Mullett, if you could advise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you may recall we had our first public hearing on House Bill 2457 on March 3rd. This bill was sponsored by Representative Dahlem, and you heard from one of his constituents about her experience where her employer had placed a video camera in the bathroom at her place of work. This bill we made a few amendments based on some of the testimony we heard that day. The amendments you should have, and what the amendments do essentially is add a provision. Let me make sure everyone has them. The amendments add a provision where to capture what we sort of refer to as upskirting, when an individual puts a camera in a bag and visually records images up typically women's clothing. And so we added a provision to capture and criminalize that behavior. Additionally, based on some testimony we heard from Mr. Hummel of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the decision was made that a peeping Tom, someone who did not visually record an image, would, as a first-time offender, be convicted of a misdemeanor. The visual recorder, however, would be treated as a felon the first time, and additionally, a peeping Tom-type person would be elevated to a felony on a second or subsequent offense. And so that's what the amendments reflect.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2457 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation as amended.
The amendments need to be adopted
first. Yes, it's a technical matter.
Okay, well, I'll move that we adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2457.
Are there any objections to the adoption of those amendments? Amendments adopted. And then we'll just go. You already made the motion.
So okay, let's get back to that part. Yeah. Okay.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Patrick?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative Thatcher, if you'll carry that to the full committee, but we'll probably ask Representative Dahlem to carry this. Close the work session. Okay. Yeah, why would I do that? Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2784. Pat Schreiner from.
Please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I brought a little map here for a little bit of show and tell, but let me start with the written part of my testimony and then I'll move to the map. My name is Pat Schreiner. I'm the commander of the Parole and Probation Division for the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. I'm here to testify regarding House Bill 2784 and express our concerns. This bill surfaces in each legislative session in some form or another, and it's always well-intentioned. Unfortunately, prohibiting sex offenders who have offended against a minor from living within 1,000 feet of a school does not increase public safety. There is no evidence to support that it does increase public safety, and there are 36 counties in Oregon that would be dealing with this, and they all have different needs. They have different resources, they have different needs, and they have different logistical issues. In the past, when this issue has been raised, we've created maps to kind of show what that would look like. And this map I have here is a map of Marion County in 2001. We do have a map that our folks just got out, got back to us yesterday or last night, but it's the coloring's all off. The coloring of the schools in that map, the coloring of the city is yellow, and so is the coloring showing the 1,000-foot buffers. So what I'd like to do is take that map back, get it fixed, because it needs to show how the buffers would impact where folks live. But on this map, what you see is, and in 2001, it was schools and daycare centers. This one is just saying schools, but any public, private school. And the dots represent offenders. Generally, Marion County is an example here. Marion County has about 500 sex offenders under supervision. Probably close to 400 live in Salem, Kaiser area, and they tend to live where there's housing, and housing is near schools. Unfortunately, there is not a place where you can where there is housing. There is not housing in industrial areas. When you start getting into over 1,000 feet from schools, sometimes you get into some high-end housing, which again, these folks generally tend not to go back to. So one of the real logistical problems in Marion County, or certainly in any of the urban areas, is if we have this 1,000-foot buffer, what are we going to do? We do know that it promotes public safety. These people have to register with the state police as a registered sex offender. They have to report to their parole and probation officer where they're living so they can be checked on. If they're homeless and we don't know where they are, we are going to decrease public safety and increase risk. Homelessness in and of itself does not necessarily have to result in recidivism, but it is a contributing factor. Lack of stability in your living situation, employment, all of those things do increase recidivism ultimately. So when we have people on supervision, knowing where they live, having them be employed, having them work their treatment program, those are all very important. The issue about where an offender lives and the 1,000-foot barrier is really determined best by working with the local community corrections program in each county and the local policymakers. Here, the Marion County Public Safety Coordinating Council would be the best place to address those issues. Neighborhood associations. We do that routinely here in Marion County, and most counties already have that relationship. Also want to just mention, in the last legislative session, when this bill came up, Senator Metzger sponsored Senate Bill 444, which we felt addressed this issue, and it did put it back on the local community corrections agencies to work with the community on defining what is near to schools and daycare centers, and then to work with them as to determine whether or not this is an appropriate living situation, and be able to say, no, this person can't live here, or to say, this is close to a school, but for public safety purposes, this is the best living arrangement. This person is going to be living with their parents. Their parents are not supportive of their criminal behavior, their deviant behavior, and they're going to help us hold them accountable. So community corrections could have that dialogue with the community. Everybody benefits from the education. It puts more eyes on that person. I know from our experience, obviously, if you go around conducting notifications and having discussions about these offenders, and then they're always on the move, we're not helping public safety. One of the things we've argued all the time about notification is once you know who they are and people in the community know who they are, it's harder for them to offend because they operate in secrecy. That's all I have for right now. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking that the intention is to put more separation between predatory sex offenders and children. And what would be the effect, in your opinion, if we limit it to not just sex offenders in general, but the specific category of predatory sex offenders and minors under, say, 13 or 14? Would it still present that huge problem?
Representative Thatcher, Chair Barker, members of the committee, to limit it to predatory. It's already, I mean, we don't have a 1,000-foot barrier for predatory. Again, we look at that on a case by case. And then are you saying if there's minors under 13 or 14?
What I'm saying is just limit the category of sex offenders, the most dangerous, and lowering the age a little bit lesser, less encompassing.
Okay. I believe it's my belief that that's exactly what community corrections is supposed to do, that we look at those on a case-by-case basis. I mean, the problem is, one of the things that could happen here is if we say you can't live within 1,000 feet of a school, now you have a predatory sex offender who's the only place they can live is next to a daycare center, and you're going, that's where we really don't want them to live. So right now we're in a position, I mean, I can speak for Marion County. I'm representing the statewide, but when you get specifics, I have to speak for Marion County. And I can tell you in Marion County, if we have a predatory sex offender who is going to be living next to a school or living next to a daycare center, that's when we utilize transitional housing resources. But in 36 counties, not everybody has transitional housing. Not everybody can sets money aside to pay for that month's rent to not put that person there. So that is one that local community corrections agencies in the community needs to address individually.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat, I'm just kind of curious, follow up a little bit on where Representative Thatcher was going on notification issue. Can you explain to us what the policy is for notification with predatory offenders here in Marion County?
Sure, I can. And if I need some help, I may turn to Sergeant Jeff Wood here because he actually manages that. But I'll take a stab at it, and then I'll turn around and look at Jeff and find out if I answered correctly. The policy is pretty intensive. I mean, what we have is we have seven parole and probation officers that only supervise sex offenders, and they have all been specially trained, attended a special sex offender supervision academy. They meet every Tuesday from 10 to noon as a unit. They meet with their Sergeant Wood, their supervisor. They meet with our sex offender treatment providers, and they staff cases. And they are staffing the cases that score predatory based on the current tool that designates a predatory status, which is the static 99 for the state of Oregon. They review those cases, and then they determine whether or not this person, what level of notification they believe this person requires. And so it's not just an officer saying, I think this person needs this. They bring it to the group, and whether they need newspaper notification, whether they need to go door to door, whether they need to contact schools. There are some general things that happen on each notification. One, we use Marion County, we use the website and post the predatory sex offenders on the website. I know yesterday they went out and they conducted four neighborhood notifications and sent that information to the newspaper, and so those four offenders will all come out in the newspaper in the near future. They used to come out the day after, but this law has been around for 10 years or more, and the newspaper does not respond as quickly as they used to. And then they respond to the people. People will call in if they want to have a meeting, if they want to talk about what the specific risks of these sex offenders are. They respond to that. It's also a great opportunity to kind of educate the public, because the public a lot of times will come with concerns and issues about sex offenders that are very worthwhile responding to, but they may not be the specific risk factors of that particular sex offender. And that's overall generally what we do. Okay. Representative Olson, Chair Barker, Jeff, Sergeant Wood just gave me the thumbs up, so I did okay.
Did he? I can't see him back there. Okay.
Hey, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schreiner, is there evidence to show the propensity to commit further sex offenses within a certain distance of one's home is. That is a sex offender much more likely to reoffend within a fairly close proximity to the sex offender's home, or do they tend to range around within the community?
Representative McPherson, Chair Barker, members of the committee, there isn't really any evidence that I've heard of at all that talks about the propensity to commit offenses near the home. And the fact that we have such a mobile society tends to argue that instead, no, they can move around, and that's where, I mean, they may offend in a variety of ways. What we do know about sex offenders is they're not a homogenous group, and they present various levels of risk depending on what their issues are. You know, I mean, pedophiles and stranger power rapists have higher risk levels than most sex offenders. There's also a smaller percentage of the sex offenders that we supervise. So each time we're dealing with a sex offender, we are focusing on the specific risk that person presents. If we have had, and I have had sex offenders before that have offended in the neighborhood or to the church they attended, then we would target, that would be the kind of person you would target, a community notification, and that's exactly where the community notification law pays off, because now everybody knows that person and they're not going to operate, but generally operating within their neighborhood or it just doesn't happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, as you were talking about the communities being involved and how people in the community can come forward and express their concerns about something happening. And I see that this bill is brought forward at the request of North Baker School students. And apparently, it's been my experience that when something is brought clear up at the state level, it's kind of a last resort situation. Perhaps there's a problem of communication. I don't know if you could go back and address that with that other county. I don't know. I'm just wondering if the community notification program is consistent throughout the state and the responses from local jurisdictions is consistent enough to not warrant having to go to the state. What is your take on it?
Well, Representative Thatcher, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sergeant Wood and I had a conversation with Representative Butler about this bill to kind of get a little background, and then I did talk to the director. Sex offending behavior is such harmful behavior that there's always going to be disputes, there's always going to be disagreements. Even in Marion County, when we conduct a notification and we say, you know, this person's living here, and this is the best place for them to live for public safety, certainly the people in that neighborhood may disagree with that. And we may have that disagreement, and we're saying we want you to know who they are and we want you to help us watch them, and their feelings are, we don't care about that. We want them out of our neighborhood. And so when I talked to the director over in Baker County, what he described to me about this offender was, this offender has one sex offense conviction in 1986, and he's on for, I believe, drug charges now. And he said he's mainly a drug offender. He is had like 15 arrests for drug offenses and one arrest for a sex offense. So they allowed him to live there. They're more concerned about him as a criminal than a sex offender. Everybody, the school, everybody knows about him. But it's one of those ones where there are going to be disagreements, and this is one of those cases.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer and Ms. Skye.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose House Bill 2784. I think that Mr. Schreiner adequately expressed most of our concerns. The only thing that I would add to that is that I think that there is a problem with the public feeling safe, and I do think that it comes from our sex offender registration laws. And it may be a time to look at all of the offenses that we require to be registered, because many of them are low-level offenses, and we've discussed this in this committee before in talking about reporting requirements and the fact that it can be someone who had, you know, a 22-year-old who had a relationship with a 17-year-old, but when a person in the community finds out that someone who is a registered sex offender lives next door to them, it creates an alarm that may not be necessary. So not only are we expending our resources requiring this person to register when it may not be necessary, but we're also causing public alarm that's difficult for people like Mr. Schreiner and community corrections to deal with. So I would urge the committee to consider looking at the sex offender registration laws and ways that we can make the community feel more safe where they are, and to allow community corrections to focus their resources on the people that really need to have the resources and the reporting and the people who should cause alarm.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, just have a question. Ms. Scott, you're suggesting then that the locals should... it should be left up to them to determine what the policy is for notification. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, absolutely.
Okay.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Indeed, Mr. Schreiner's testimony not only set forth the in general our opposition to the bill, but actually the very reasons for why we are quite concerned with it. So it's not necessary, I think, to repeat this. He did it very well.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I want to apologize first for the confusion. I had confused this bill with 3419, the telephone. The witnesses who wanted to testify by phone are actually wanting to testify by phone on this bill, not 3419. So my apologies to persons on 3419. But we will get these people on the phone quickly and then hopefully get to 3419. Hi, Ms. Smith. My name is Heidi Moad, and I am the committee administrator for the House Judiciary Committee. You're on speakerphone. And what I'm going to do is put the microphone up to the speaker, and then we'll ask you to identify yourself for the record and tell us why you support House Bill 34 or House Bill 2784.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairperson and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Smith, and I am the PTO president at North Baker Elementary School here in Baker City, Oregon. And we had a situation where, while reading the paper, the record report, there was a sex offender that failed to register that lived on the same block as our school. Our school takes up a city block, and there are four homes that back up onto the playground. These homes have very low, if no fence at all, in their backyards, and so as our children are playing, soccer balls, baseballs, you know, everything gets back there in the backyard, and the children are constantly, you know, back and forth in and around these homes. And so it was very frightening to us to realize that a sex offender, you know, occupied one of these homes. And as we proceeded to see how we could change that, we realized that legally there was nothing that could be done, and every place we went, that's what they kept telling us. We tried to appeal to the people who owned the home that was renting to this man, and of course, like most homeowners, they were just concerned whether the person could pay their monthly rent or not. And therefore, we gathered our petitions, our signatures together, and sent this petition off to you, hoping that you would realize that this is not right. People should not, you know, sex offenders should not live next to a school or within the path that kids take to get to school. And this was our case. There was another situation in Baker at another school, South Baker, and they had the same thing, but their sex offender had toys in the yard, even though he did not have any children, placed these things that kids would naturally be interested in as they walked to and from school. And the only recourse that the South Baker parents had was to, you know, notify all the parents whose children walked to school that this was the situation and that they needed to, you know, proceed with caution. We're hoping that, you know, we don't have to do that because our legal system will take care of our children as they come to school, as they are at school. And this is my hope. And hopefully it's something that is important to you as well as to all the parents whose children attend these schools.
Okay, thank you. Committee, are there any questions? Representative McPherson?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Smith, first of all, thank you very much for contacting us and participating in this hearing. It's great to have input from a far corner of the state, but it's very important to us that we make sure that we're doing right by all Oregonians. But my question is, did you contact the community corrections officials there in Baker County about this sex offender and what kind of management program ought to apply to him?
I did not personally because as PTO president, we assigned those duties to Lori Rowland, and I believe that you have her number as well. And
yes.
She was the one that contacted probation officers, police department. She would be the one that would have all that information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Hi, Marcia. This is Representative Wilson. I have several questions I'd like to ask you. First, in the letter that you have that you've sent to the governor that we have a copy of here that is dated August 20th, 2004, what I'm curious about is the subject that you've described that lives within a school there, what crime did that subject commit? Do you know?
It was it had to do with a 15-year-old girl. He was living in the home at the time and had sexual relations with the mother as well as the daughter.
Okay, so we're looking at something like sexual abuse then. Do you know when that occurred?
I do not.
Okay, it wasn't something recent.
No, I don't think so. In fact, the owner of the home, as he approached us, because he was aware that we were collecting, you know, signatures, told us that he had met this man in prison. And that he, you know, it was a situation where, you know, it wasn't his fault, and just had a lot of excuses for you know, how terrible it was that this man had this label, and really thought that we should, you know, not continue, you know, in our quest to end this kind of people being able to live next to our school. And as I told him, you know, had he been a responsible person, he would have, because the reason why we found out about it was that he failed to register. Therefore, it was printed up in the paper, and his address was given, you know, our school address. And if he was a responsible person, then he would have done what needed to be done, and we would have never have found out about it, which is kind of scary in itself. So I think the way the bill is written, if they are sex offenders, that, you know, somebody, the probation officer, the police, somebody knows about it, and you know, they are aware of where they live and how close they can be to children.
Okay, just Mr. Chair, just a couple more questions I have. Marcia, do you know whether or not this person is identified as a sexual predator?
I believe that is true.
policy of notification is over there in Baker County through parole and probation?
I do not, but maybe Lori does. But as far as whatever we were told, there was no legal way to remove him from that home.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Smith. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and now we will hang up on you and we'll call Ms. Roller.
That would be great. I do have a question, though. As I read through the bill itself, before it starts, it's the second paragraph after summary, and it says requires a special condition of probation, post-prison supervision, and parole that certain sex offenders... Does certain sex offenders mean whether they're predatory or not?
Ms. Moore, good morning.
Ms. Smith, according to the way the statute is drafted, in order for this restriction to apply, the individual had to have been convicted of a sex offense and the victim of that crime had to be under 18 years of age.
Okay. So the label predatory does not have to be part of the condition.
Correct.
That's excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate yours.
Bye-bye. Hello?
Hi, Ms. Rowland. This is Heidi Millett. I am the committee administrator for the House Judiciary Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And we have you on speakerphone, and we would like to just ask you to go ahead and testify about your support of House Bill 2784, please.
All right. My name is Lori Rowland, and I live in Baker City. I live across the street from North Baker School, where my son goes to school. I've never done this before, but... We noticed in the paper that a sex offender, you know, we didn't even know he was there in our neighborhood, and we noticed in the paper that he had failed to register, and that's how we became aware of this person's, you know, whereabouts. And he rented a home, and the home he rented shared a property line with the playground at North Baker School, and this person's crime involved a minor. And we became, you know, of course, very concerned about his presence there because he's right where he can watch the kids at recess. And we, you know, made some phone calls and discovered that we had no legal, you know, nothing that we could do to have him removed from that property. So that is the reason that we wrote the letter and we gathered some signatures. And we felt that this was not a good place for this person to be, and we wanted to take steps to protect them, you know, to protect the kids and protect other kids. I mean, it needs to be addressed statewide, you know, and we just felt this was a bad location for him to be. You know, and we sure hope and we appreciate, we hope we can do something to get them... where they can't be in those positions, where they can watch the kids.
Okay, thank you. committee, are there any questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rowland, did you contact the community corrections officials in Baker County to give input about the management plan for or the approach for supervision of this offender?
I actually contacted his parole officer, and his parole officer said that they, you know, it was a concern to the parole officers statewide because apparently they have an organization too, but that there was no state law in which they could enforce any of this. Unless this sex offender is a predatory sex offender, and he was not a predatory offender, that we did not have to register him with a school or anything. He has to register with the parole people, but he does not have to be notified, you know, neighbors and
the schools don't have to have any notification. We really, you know, at first we thought we were going to be able to make a few phone calls and have somebody remove him, but we just found out that we didn't have any law that we could do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Hey, thank you very much, Ms. Rowland. We really appreciate you taking the time to meet with us on over the phone like this and give your information to the committee.
Well, I appreciate you guys, you know, working on it. I think it's something, and that's the one thing, when we went to the school, you know, everybody was concerned and everybody signed. It's something we all wanted to support.
Mr. Chair.
We appreciate you guys.
Okay, one moment, please. Representative Olson. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Lori. This is Representative Olson, and I do have a couple questions now. We just had some conversation with Marcia Smith a few minutes ago, and actually I'm going to ask some questions similar that I asked of her. Since you've talked with the folks over there with parole and probation, and you've learned a little bit of the history of the sex offender, can you share with us what you know the offense was that this individual committed?
I don't know, you know, all the details, but my understanding is that he had perhaps, I think he lived with a mother and a daughter, and then got involved with the daughter as he was involved with the mother as well, and the daughter was, I think, maybe 14 or 15 at the time. And I don't honestly know all the details. That's just what I was told. But, you know, like at our school here at North Baker, we have sixth graders who are, you know, 12, 13 years old, and we just were concerned for their safety.
Do you know when this occurred?
It occurred, it was close to 10 years ago. And, you know, in all honesty, we had no problems with the man. He did not say anything or contact any of the kids. He never did anything to any of the students. We wouldn't have even known about it had we not seen that he failed to register as a sex offender, because they listed his address in the paper. And, of course, you know what? He lives right across the street from me. He doesn't live there anymore. And he never did do anything that we were concerned about. And as we were talking to the parole officer here in Baker, he told me that there were 70 other sex offenders in Baker, which, you know, we have a population of just under 10,000. And he said that only two of the sex offenders that we have were predatory sex offenders. And so that left all the others, you know, they're just kind of sprinkled throughout the community. And I know, you know, chances are pretty good. There's another one or two around our school. There's probably, you know, a couple around all the other grade schools as well. And, you know, we let our kids walk to school, and we're kind of, you know, we were disturbed when we found out that our kids had been walking right past this man's house. We didn't even have an ability to, you know, tell our kids to take a different route or you know, walk together or, you know what I mean? We were just completely surprised by this.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Rowland.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2784. We will not be back to work session today. With apologies to those who can wait, we'll get right on House Bill, open a public hearing on House Bill 3419. Representative Ms. Kitts, please come up. Rick Kaiser and Chuck. Good morning. I apologize for the noise. That's a phone
Mr. Chairman, it's quite all right. You're doing your job. We are more than happy to wait, and we'll be more than happy to do ours. Representative Derek Kitts, House District 30. For the record, I'll go ahead and let everybody introduce themselves.
Joe Kaiser, Hillsborough City Councilor. And I'm representing Chuck Riley from District 29, Hillsborough, Cornelius Forest Grove.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. I'm going to talk briefly, and I mean briefly, and then pass the mic over to Councilman Kaiser, who is actually the individual that brought this bill concept forward to myself and Representative Riley, asking us to please do something at this level because something desperately needed to be done. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank the Chairman of the Full Judiciary, Representative Krieger, and yourself for hearing this bill today. House Bill 3419 simply prohibits that the mutual a cohabitation of parolees and post-prison supervision of sex offenders may not reside in the same dwelling as other sex offenders. I will turn it over to Representative Kaiser to explain the genesis of where this bill comes from.
Thank you, Representative Kitts. Again, for the record, Joe Kaiser, Hillsborough City Councilor, 755 Southeast Hacienda Street, Hillsborough, Oregon. Just quickly to kind of let you know where this bill came from, we had a situation that occurred in the city of Hillsborough in February, which was brought to our attention that we had a number, and I believe it was 8 sex offenders living in one dwelling in the city of Hillsborough off Belmont Court. The interesting thing in this situation is that it wasn't a random placement of 8 sex offenders. It was actually a placement based on the advice of a probation parole officer and an individual who's creating housing specifically for this reason. The situation that came to light for us was we thought potentially we had the opportunity to put a stop to this through code law, and it's not possible. There's a law that states no more than 5 individuals living in one house that are not related by family. That law in particular in the state of Oregon has suffered some judicial defeat, and so it wasn't thought by our attorney that that was a potential way to fix the problem. What ended up happening is there was a lot of social pressure put on by the neighborhood. The city council expressed outrage, and they terminated the housing unit and had everybody move out. The unfortunate part of this is that apparently there are a lot more of these. It's not something that's commonplace, but it's not rare either. In fact, the report that we got, and to some degree this is hearsay, but the report that we received was that there were up to 14 or 15 additional sites like this in Washington County. Our understanding is that, of course, as we heard from the previous bills, it's not an easy thing to cite sex offenders, and it's certainly not an easy thing for them to find housing. However, I think the community felt, if I could speak on behalf of the community, I think the community felt that actually putting sex offenders in a situation where they're living together in a particular neighborhood in a concentrated spot is likely to increase their recidivism. And I think we thought that it might even be an exponential factor. We wanted to make sure with this bill that we didn't do anything that would cause an effect to halfway houses or treatment centers for sex offenders. That's not our issue at all. It's moreover, these individuals were unsupervised. There was no indication that that they attempted to do anything within the neighborhood, but it was obviously caused a lot of outrage. And we tend to agree with it. I think the worst part about this, and in many respects, even in this case, the sex offenders end up being victims of this, is that the individual who owns these homes and has been marketing this is actually taking, in this case, took a 4-bedroom dwelling home, turned it into an 8-bedroom dwelling home, and then put 8 sex offenders each in a single different room, sharing, cohabitating a kitchen and bathrooms, etc., and then charged, we're told, anywhere from $800 to $1,000 a month rent for it, per room. I mean, it's obviously an enterprise that was working well for whoever the entrepreneur is, but not one that's very healthy for the community. So from our standpoint, we thought that this would be a simpler fix than going through the courts and trying to fight an uphill battle against the code issue that has been at times thrown out by various different courts here in Oregon and in the U.S., and so we were hoping that this committee would see likewise and move the bill forward. Any questions?
Joe, I spoke with Representative Riley about this, so this kind of a house would be okay if there was supervision there. Is that right?
Yeah, my understanding, Chair Barker, is that if you had a situation where you had a residential facility where there were a number of sex offenders that were receiving treatment, were receiving supervision, and you know, there was somebody who was monitoring what kind of conversations are occurring, what kind of materials were coming through the house, etc. There's no intent here to change that. I think that we, like everyone else, would like to see that they get the proper treatment. It just wasn't the case in this facility. There was no one. It was just merely 8 sex offenders living in the house.
Thank you. Real quick, just you said that this type of situation would probably increase recidivism, or is it shown to increase recidivism?
I don't want to give you the impression that I'm in any way a criminologist and would know whether or not it would. It would seemingly put them in a situation where that could happen. You know, the other thought, I suppose, would be that living together they could commiserate, but I don't think that is something that was very comforting for the neighbors. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kaiser, it strikes me that this bill may be broader than what you're trying to get at. I mean, the issue you're trying to get at, I think, is a decision by the parole and probation folks that they shouldn't be having unsupervised facilities that they set up, that they arrange. They require people as a condition of their probation or parole to live together in a facility, and that you're not really aimed at a situation where it happens that two people who just by coincidence or because they became acquainted when they were incarcerated happen to reside together. Am I understanding the situation correctly?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I think you're on to something there. I think that's true in many respects. I think there's also a train of thought that maybe it's not a good thing overall for the state, but from our standpoint, from the city of Hillsborough's standpoint, our concern lies directly with this situation, and I wouldn't want to extrapolate on that too far. I think I would leave that to the good representatives to do.
Yeah, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, thank you for the question. I think the intent of this bill is this was a poor decision by this individual to go ahead and allow this. We want to prohibit these poor decisions from being made. If it needs to be done in law, then I'm more than willing to come here and defend my community if that's what it takes, because it's not currently being done, and there's nothing to stop it from being done. This person didn't break the law. This is not against the law for this person to charge $1,000 for 8 of these people to be stuffed in a house next to a school. It's not against the law, and I'm saying it should be. My thought, my bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, again, I'm Chuck Riley. I'm representing the House District 29, Conyers, Hillsborough, and Forest Grove. Most of what I wanted to say has been said by the other members of this panel, and I won't go into that, but I want you to imagine for a moment how you'd feel when you're informed that your house in a suburban cul-de-sac where you live with your family, your two children, has 8 sex offenders in a house in the same cul-de-sac, and that's exactly what's happened to some of our neighbors in Hillsborough. I urge you to pass this out with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I know, if I might,
sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that the bill 3419 is scheduled for a public hearing today, and I know it is the chair's prerogative to have a work session if the chair sees fit. I would encourage the chair to do that. If the chair needs more information at the end of this, then I'm more than happy to provide any information that the chair does need. And those that are opposed to the bill, I would question the validity of my bill in regards to why they're opposing it. I don't think the arguments that you will hear come forward don't deal with the merits of this bill. This was a bad decision made by an individual. What the decision that was made was not against the law, and that's the question the committee has to weigh, is should that decision have been against the law? Should the people in that community be put in that situation where an individual is able to take advantage of a situation like this individual did? And my answer is no. So thank you, committee. Appreciate your time.
Representative Kitts, I'm just trying to anticipate some of the arguments against it. I can think of a possibility of a case where a mother or, you know, married couple or couple, whatever, is involved in some kind of activity where both of those people, maybe a married couple, would be registered sex offenders.
A husband and a wife would both be registered sex offenders and married and living together. Well, I would accept amendments to the bill that said if two sex offenders were married, I would like to see case study of that ever occurring. And if it has, then
I don't know that it has.
Well, I might just offer up the I mean, there are these sort of notorious cases, not necessarily in Oregon, of preschools where there was alleged kind of sexual misconduct pervading through the whole preschool.
And you had families involved in that. Just, I mean, that's...
Well, actually, Chair Barker, if I may.
Sure,
I see the validity of your of the potential argument there. I think the interesting question would be whether or not, if you had that situation, potentially those people should be cohabitating together anyway. That doesn't mean, you know, clearly marriage is what it is. It's a legal contract and it should be followed. But the point being, I think our concern is that probably not the best situation in the world and probably aren't a lot of circumstances where it's a good thing, period.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add for the record, your committee administrator's beauty is second only to that of her mother.
No, you can't say that.
Then I take it back.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Meyer?
It wasn't genetic.
From the mother.
Thank you, Chair.
Amen.
Oh,
you
guys have control.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing this bill today. My name is Christine Dwyer. D-W-Y-E-R. I reside at 5032 Southeast Belmont Court in Hillsborough. We reside directly across the street from the home that Mr. Kaiser was speaking about earlier. Our neighborhood, these men were not predatory sex offenders, so we were not notified. It was quite by accident that we found out that these men were living across the street. My husband happened to recognize a volunteer who was helping refurbish the home, and he knew them from work, and the guy said, you know, do you have kids? And my husband said, yes, three of them. He said, you need to come with me. You need to keep your kids away from these guys. So at that point, we started looking further into it, called the probation department, found that, yes, these men were sex offenders, that at the time, five were living in the home. When we found out, four of those five were convicted of crimes against minors. Upon looking into this further, we found out that the man who owns the home also owns 23 other homes. 12 of those homes are homes for sex offenders, and they're all in Washington County. They're in various locations. I tried to look into that further, but I don't have the resources to find out which ones are regular rentals and which ones are sex offender rentals. I have supplied in the packet of information pictures of what he did to the home, where he took... They added two bedrooms and a two-car garage, took the bonus room, family room area, turned that into a bedroom, and then there's a detached shop that is not attached to the home that was the previous owner had built it to fix cars. He was in the process of renovating that into two additional bedrooms, no plumbing. So how the men were supposed to use the restroom in the middle of the night or any of that, I don't know. Luckily, through us going to the city council and the city council becoming outraged and having negotiations with the owners, it was decided it was in the best interest of the community and I believe the homeowner himself to have the men move out. Since this has happened, there were 15 children under the ages of 15 that live on our cul-de-sac when this we found out about this. There are five families now in the process of moving. The men are out now, but it's just kind of, you know, the whole family atmosphere of the neighborhood is just to the point where people are, yeah, maybe it's time we just get out of here. He still owns the home, even though the sex offenders aren't living there now. What concerns me is the fact that there are 12 other homes that he has like this. And there's families probably who aren't aware that they're living next door to that many sex offenders. And it can't be a good thing to live, you know, right next door to a high concentration of sex offenders like that. I also wanted to point out this is not something that's unique to our area or even unique to our state. I was doing research on this bill, and I stumbled upon the Illinois House of Representatives recently passed a bill that would limit, you couldn't have two sex offenders cohabitating, and it is now in the Senate Rules Committee waiting to be passed through that. So I've also supplied that information in the packet. And I think it would also be best for the men not to be put in a situation where not only are the neighbors fearful of them, if they're truly trying to rehabilitate, I would think they wouldn't want to be in a situation like they were in, especially the men who were going to be living without a restroom, or that doesn't seem like it would be a good thing for them. Any questions?
Thank you. The homeowner, is he just, is that what he does for a living? He owns homes, or he does something else?
He has a business card, actually, that has his name and says, housing for convicts, and that's his business card. So that is what he does for a living.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Again, Mr. Schreiner, Ms. Skye, and Ms. Meyer.
That is right. That's right, $1,000 each.
Yeah. Job security. Yeah. I'm just this guy. Yeah. It looks like they're going to allow you to carry the water again. Okay. Please go ahead.
Okay. Again, Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm still Pat Schreiner with the Sheriff's Office in Marion County, and I am once again speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network, and I'm here to testify regarding House Bill 3419 and express our concerns about this bill. The concept that dangerous people reinforce and collude with other dangerous people may be true for certain criminal populations. It is not true, however, for sex offenders. The underlying assumption is that allowing sex offenders to live together without on-site supervision will create a dangerous pack of predators and new victims. However, in reality, this is not true. A prerequisite for allowing sex offenders to live together is the building component of supervision, parole and probation supervision, and treatment, sex offender treatment. Unlike other types of violent crime, sexual offending rarely occurs in a group or with multiple perpetrators. Sexual assault most often occurs in secret and involves a significant amount of manipulation and deception. Sexual deviancy is a private and personal matter rarely shared with other sex offenders. Sex offenders may share their cynicism and resentment, but they do not share their deviance. Additionally, sex offenders are violators of trust and as such do not trust each other. Due to the characterological issues of sex offenders, the issue is more likely, what will happen more likely with these folks is they tend to rat each other out when they're in a group living situation. And part of that is to gain the favor of the people that are holding them accountable, their supervising officer, their treatment provider. A study conducted by the Colorado Division of Criminal Justice in 2004 indicated that high-risk sex offenders living in shared living arrangements had a lower recidivism rate and a lower probation violation rate than high-risk sex offenders who were not in shared living arrangements. In fact, the people that were living with their family had a higher recidivism and a higher violation rate than the people in the shared living arrangements in the study in Colorado. Additionally, this study reported that offenders in shared living reported out their probation violations on each other at a significantly higher rate. Again, going back to the fact that they're more likely to rat each other out. They know what all the rules are, and they want to look good for their treatment provider and their PO. This means that a sex offender's deviant cycle is interrupted sooner, which promotes public safety. One of the keys to this being effective is that these sex offenders are on supervision and in treatment. we know that this legislation's well-intended. When I'm back there listening to this, I'm going, eight sex offenders living in a house in that situation, I agree. I wouldn't approve that in Marion County. I also can tell you that there are, and I can't tell you here today how many, but there's scatterings of two or three sex offenders in Marion County that have come to live together as a way to make rent so they have a place to live versus being homeless. Again, that's approved by their PO and their treatment provider, and if we know where they are and they're accountable, that increases public safety. So we believe that shared living arrangements among this population can be evaluated and worked out. Again, coming back to a similar theme, I think it's a local issue. I think the folks in Washington County had a significant issue, particularly in this house, and maybe they have. I know when I first came to Marion County in 1989, the transitional housing in Marion County was awful. It's made dramatic improvements. There's things like Oxford houses, which, by the way, do not rent to sex offenders. There's faith-based transitional houses that will rent to sex offenders and provide some on-site supervision. But as far as really on-site supervision and the kind of supervision, the state of Oregon does not have halfway houses anymore. We moved away from that many, many years ago, and that would be a significant funding issue. So I would come back to my recommendation would be that local community corrections and communities work together to deal with this issue and have that kind of conversation rather than legislate a law saying sex offenders can never live together, because once again we'll have an increase in homeless sex offenders, which isn't good for the community. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair. Thank you. You mentioned that you wouldn't personally be in favor of eight living together. What would be personally acceptable to you?
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, the study out of Colorado indicated 3 to 4 in shared living arrangements was very positive. That was where they were citing reducing the recidivism. The main reason I mean, eight, not so much sex offenders, it's eight criminal offenders. Sex offenders don't always reoffend just as a sex offender. Depends on their level of risk. And so we have transitional houses where there's some on-site supervision where that makes sense. There's also a part of this bill that comes to you as a political sensibility issue. If there was eight sex offenders living in a house in my neighborhood would be upset, and they'd be coming, well, they'd probably come to my house, they'd be coming to Community Corrections and saying, do something about this. And that's where I think Community Corrections does have an obligation to have that conversation and be communicating with people and working those issues.
You have another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about the funding issues and that supervision isn't feasible or practical. And if I recall, they were saying that these bedrooms were going for $800 to $1,000 per person. And perhaps part of the condition of them having that home could be to go to purchasing some supervision. You know, if you were going to go with a 3 to 4 scenario, just saying.
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, that's an amazing amount. I don't know where, that would tell me that these people all have really good jobs and are paying for it, because I know that when we subsidize housing for offenders, not just sex offenders, but folks going to Oxford houses or transitional housing, which we'll do for a month or two at a time, again, to give them a chance to reintegrate into the community, we pay $300 a month. And then we'd say, you need to get a job because, we can do this for a month. We can maybe do this for 2 months, but we can't do it further than that. So eight people paying $800 to $1,000 a month, they must be working and making some good money doing something.
Thank you, Ms. Skye.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, again, Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I don't have a lot to add to what Mr. Schreiner has said. I do echo his concerns. This is a very complex area. Again, sex offender registration applies to a very broad spectrum of sex offenses, and I think that it's best to leave the plans and the supervision of these sex offenders to the experts, and that's really what they've become, working with polygraphers and psychologists to determine what is best for sex offenders in a reality that includes the fact that it's very hard for a sex offender, for anybody with a felony conviction, to find housing, to find a job, and to become a productive member of society. So I think that that's best done at a level where people truly understand the nature of the offenses, the risk factors for recidivism, and can assist these people becoming productive members of society.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, ACLU of Oregon. We, too, oppose House Bill 3419. I think the earlier testimony you heard about this individual who's now marketing to this population really points out the fundamental problems and the very serious problems we have in this state in terms of providing housing for this community. There is no requirement to make housing available or any duty to anyone to do that. And the problem is that it is becoming increasingly difficult for individuals to find housing. So this person's found a niche because there is some desperation to have housing available in the limited resources that are. I think one of the things that I think is at play in this is the concern or the tension in terms of that house and the reconstruction done to that house and zoning issues. And I think when we're looking at that dynamic, we're looking at squeezing in 8 adults into a house that there may have been some issues for zoning, and we shouldn't confuse that with a house that we would perceive normally can house 6 adults or 8 adults or 4 adults, and not confuse the dynamics at play. I think Mr. Schreiner has talked about the evidence, in fact, that there is evidence to support that more than one sex offender residing together helps community safety, doesn't detract from it. And finally, this bill and the previous bill just points out something that we all need to do, which is to really educate our children about the need to understand that you may not know your neighbors or who you're interacting with, whether they're strangers or people you know through your community, that they need to practice and be aware of the safety that they need to take in all those interactions. So I appreciate your time. Happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have some follow-up questions. I guess actually it goes back to Pat Schreiner. I've been chewing on some of this here a little bit with your testimony, Pat. One question you have here on your first page, you talk about sexual assault most often occurs in secret and involves a significant amount of manipulation and deception. I mean, I've been involved in investigating a few sex crimes in my career. Do you see the potential of that environment creating stimulation for further behavior?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, members of the committee, are you talking about in a housing situation where sex offenders are living together? What the evidence tells us is that sex offenders do not like to share that information with each other. So there isn't any evidence that that's what they do. There isn't any studies that indicate that they do offend together in packs. With your experience, you know the way criminal gangs work. They're proud of what they do. There's a level of esteem that comes to that criminal enterprise. That's not really true with this population. They do operate in secrecy and deception. So the fact that they're in the same house, and in the study in Colorado, was what they tended to do was they tended to tell on each other when they did something that was, and most sex offenders, except for that very small percentage of very dangerous predatory rapists, most sex offenders groom. They set up their victims. They establish a relationship. One of the benefits of the study of Colorado indicates that the fact that they rat each other out is they have a conversation with a child. That is the first step in the grooming process, because their conditions say no contact with children. Now they go to group, and the other person in group tells on them. So the studies seem to indicate the opposite, that they're not getting together saying how can we do something deviant and sexual. They don't trust people enough to do that anyway.
Okay. Just a follow-up question. You've heard testimony regarding what occurred up in Hillsborough and everything with this one house with eight offenders residing in it. And I know that that's not your jurisdiction in Washington County. How would you respond to that for the concerns of the neighbors in that immediate area dealing with that situation?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, and members of the community committee. I think I'll stay out of Hillsborough right now. I really think the issue is community corrections needs to be meeting with those folks, and you need to have these kinds of conversations about when group living, shared living arrangements can work and when it cannot. And I think community corrections, we also need to be sensitive to the fact that eight offenders in a house, and particularly in this kind of situation, was probably politically a very bad move. And without some education, without some, a relationship with the people in those community, it looks like they were just putting a bunch of really high-risk, dangerous people in there. Now, if you would have moved, the Free Souls motorcycle gang moved in, everybody would have known about it right away, and everybody would have agreed about the potential risk level, because that's a criminal enterprise coming in there. So I really think the big issue is the communication that goes on locally.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, panel.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schreiner, seems to me there's a problem that needs a solution here, which is that we all collectively want to label sex offenders, and then we don't want them living near us, which means it's hard for them to find housing, which means that it creates sort of a niche opportunity for an entrepreneur, in this case, to put a really high concentration of people together. Sort of the natural forces that are arising out of this area of activity of registering sex offenders. Is there some level of scale, though, that would be an appropriate response to the situation? If it's overly broad in this proposal to say no to sex offenders, certainly eight seems like an unfair burden for a neighborhood to have to absorb. Is there a number of three or four that would make sense?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, and members of the committee, I think if we took that study out of Colorado, which is fairly due, I mean, I saw that 3 months ago was when that came to light for us in Oregon. Maybe that's a model that we could look at and work that issue. You are absolutely right. The depth of this problem, community corrections struggles with it, communities struggle with it. Obviously, if we need to be careful that we don't seal off all housing opportunities, because we do know that's a contributing factor to people saying, "What does it matter? I might as well continue my criminal lifestyle because I have nowhere to go and I have no opportunities." So perhaps there is some middle ground that could be found, and we'd be happy to work on that issue, because I agree. I think if you're going to put eight people in a house, you should have on-site supervision. There are transitional houses that do that. And there's places, three or four in Marion County, that are living together, I'm sure right now as I speak, that they're doing fine. And that seems to fit with the study out of Colorado.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, if I can just add, I think we do need to leave it at the local level and be very cautious about setting a hard and fast rule. Because I can imagine, as you heard in the first bill on this issue today, most neighbors, if given a vote, would say one is too many, and three is too many, and four. And I don't think you're ever going to satisfy the concept of these folks are in a community, we have to absorb them in our community. So I appreciate, I know where you're trying to go, but I do raise that caution that I think we need to leave it at the local level and let those dynamics play out for the particular situations.
and appropriate for those particular situations.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. We will not move this to work session today. I appreciate Representative Kitts Riley and Councillor Aldrey.
Kaiser.
Boy. We're coming down. What I'd like to do is ask you to work with Mr. Schreiner and keep in touch possibly with the defense bar as well. This is, we do need the law. It's very clear we need something here. We need to give the local, it is good to have local control. We need to give them some tools to work with. And as you saw, there were some problems with the broad, with this broad of a brush. So I appreciate if you could work with that and keep in contact with the committee administrator. And in a short period of time, we come up with some amendments. I think we'd, I'd like to run this bill. Thank you very much.
I think we can do them together. Okay. They're basically covering the same stuff. We may want to. And
no.
No.
Okay.
And then I'll get the other judge on the phone when we are calling up Judge Lipscomb.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on two bills now, House Bill 2792 and House Bill 3020. Since they cover some of the same ground, we have some witnesses that will double up on that.
We'll call Judge Lipscomb.
Okay, we're going to call Judge Lipscomb.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go ahead and get Judge Pratt on the phone as well so he can hear Judge Lipscomb's testimony and then testify immediately after that.
Okay.
Hi, this is Heidi Moad from the Judiciary Committee calling for Judge Pratt. Thanks. You know, all right, I'm going to, what I'll do is call back in about 5 to 10 minutes. We've got a couple of other judges ready to testify now.
Oh, all right. Can you name it down?
This is Heidi Moa.
Heidi.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Lipscomb. I'm the presiding judge here in Marion County. I'm also chair of the Judicial Department Statewide Security Committee. About a year ago, last spring, the Chief Justice appointed a new statewide court security committee because concern had been growing for some time that we weren't doing enough about this subject in the state of Oregon, and he asked me to chair it. Scott Crampton, who's here with me today from the State Court Administrator's Office, serves with us on that committee. The committee consists not only of judges and trial court administrators and representative from the state court's office, but also representatives of the sheriff's offices and other security offices throughout the state of Oregon. We began with relatively modest goals for improving the state of security in our courts last spring. The plan, what we hoped to do was expand the planning function of the court security improvement plans to cover also natural disaster planning, emergency preparedness, and business continuity so that if a disaster struck of whatever kind, we would have plans in place to respond to them and to plan to continue in business so that the rule of law could continue to be in effect regardless of the scope of the disaster. So the committee has worked towards legislation that you see before you in the form of House Bill 3020. Has also developed, working on developing, and now has a draft model plan for each local jurisdiction to review and consider whether that's what they want to do or something along those lines. And we've also been attempting, the other goal was to increase training, security training, and awareness at the local and statewide level. So what you see before you really is a fairly limited bill of fairly limited scope. It would expand security planning into the area of natural disasters, planning and preparing for events of nature rather than events of man, and preparing and planning as to how we're going to continue doing business. Experience, and not just in this state, but throughout the nation, is that natural disasters are a much more common problem for us to have to deal with. The recent fire in Hermiston that wiped out their temporary courtroom or courthouse there, the earthquake in Klamath Falls a few years back that totally wiped out their courthouse, and they had to start from scratch, build another courthouse, which took a number of years. And they had somehow to find a way to maintain court and the operation of law in the meantime. Whether it's those kinds of natural disasters or whether it's a tsunami that comes or a Columbus Day storm or a volcano like Mount St. Helens, each community is at risk to some extent of some kind of natural occurrence. And so our feeling is it only makes sense to plan and prepare for that, and so that we're in better position to respond in times of emergency and are better coordinated with the local law enforcement officers and the other first responders in the area. That was where we began. With the events in March in the national news, I think things have taken something of a different turn. I think everyone recalls that the federal judges family was killed in Chicago, the husband of a federal judge there and her mother, and also the horrific killings that occurred in Atlanta when the convict took away a firearm from the officer who was escorting him into the courtroom and turned her gun on the officer and on the judge and on other people who happened to be in his way. As a result of those two incidents coming rather close together in time, nationwide, I think there's now a renewed interest in protecting our courts and judges. People realize that it is a problem. They've heard that it's a problem, but now I think the impact of it has begun to hit home. The courts and judges are subject to violent attacks, not only in the courthouse, but also in their own homes. Anywhere outside the courthouse. There's a national symposium that's going to be taking place later this month in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the National Center for State Courts, April 21st and 22nd. We're looking forward to the information and suggestions that come out of there. But I think the lesson from all this is really that protection of judges and of our justice system is essential if we're going to maintain an independent judiciary, and decisions are to be made on the law and on the merits, and they're not colored by fear or intimidation of brought on by fears related to one's personal security. These aren't just national problems. They're occurring not only in other states, but in our state system as well. Before you, you have two separate staple documents. The first deals with some serious threats that have occurred in Marion County outside of the Marion County Courthouse. One is still under investigation, and that's the first one you have. Just this last March, we were advised by the Oregon State Police that they had received a threat to kill a judge. It turns out that the suspect involved had advised a Linn County deputy sheriff that he was writing a book on court security and how easy it would be to kill a judge. And he said that he told the deputy down in Linn County that he could kill a judge in Wilson Park in Salem anytime he wanted to, and mentioned that Judge Lipscomb was the judge who ran in Wilson Park every day. Well, Judge Lipscomb doesn't run in Wilson Park every day anymore. And we don't know yet exactly how serious that was, but it did catch my attention. In January of 2003, a male was found standing on the front steps of Judge Tripp's home at night at about 9 p.m., had not rung the doorbell or anything, and when he was encountered, I think she came home. He said he was there to clean the carpets. He then jumped off the steps and fled. The vehicle, we had excellent police response. The Salem PD actually stopped that vehicle, I think, before it actually left the neighborhood, within just five or six blocks from the house. And there were four felons riding in the vehicle at the time. Never did figure out what that was all about, but very disconcerting for Judge Tripp and for the rest of us as well. Probably the most serious incident that we've had in Marion County locally were back in October, shortly after the PERS decision came down, and I received quite a number of threatening phone calls directed to my home phone as well as the office phone. And while I was out of town, elk hunting, an extremely threatening letter was mailed to me and to my wife at our home address, which in and of itself I think was an attempt at intimidation, letting us know that they knew where we lived. And my wife opened the letter while I was gone, and attached to your second, at the top of your second packet, is actually a copy of the letter. I won't read the whole thing. But it is a direct attempt at intimidation following the PERS decision. He says in part, "If your idiotic views affect my pension and those of others like me, you may well wish you had given it a little more thought. You want to come along and wipe out our pension benefits. If that happens, I would advise you to look for another state to live in. Want to call the cops? We are the blank cops, you fool. Who do you think is going to protect your sorry ass? Better watch your back, you little blankety blank." There were others ringing the doorbell during the night. It went on for a couple of weeks and eventually died out. Those are things that happen outside the courthouse. In Marion County, we also have one of the best courthouse security systems that exists in the state. Most states or most local courts aren't as fortunate as we are. In the packet behind the letter, however, are weapons that have been taken away at the front door by our front door security people from people entering the courthouse, seeing the equipment there, the x-ray equipment, seeing the metal detectors, and walking through it with weapons anyway. You wouldn't believe that would happen. You would think that the simple knowledge that their equipment was going to be subject to x-ray or that they were passing through a metal detector would be sufficient to get those people to return to their vehicles and leave their weapons there. But people do surprising things. We've had a number of revolvers, more than just the two that are here. We've had one stun gun. There's a picture of that here. Perhaps the most frightening exhibit to me, because there's no legitimate purpose for this at all coming into a courthouse, is the butcher knife that was in the lining of a gentleman's coat, and he was going to domestic relations court regarding a custody matter. It's very difficult to prove that prevention works because there's really no evidence of what you have prevented, but I'm convinced that this prevented a very serious crime. And I think perhaps some of the others did too. This is another item. I just received this last night from our sheriff's department. This was taken from a gentleman in December of 2003. And it's a pretty intimidating looking cane if you just look at the way it appears. but if you unscrew the handle, it becomes a sword that's good for no purpose at all other than harming another human being. And this was discovered only on the X-ray machine. As I say, many and probably most of our courthouses in the state still don't have X-ray machines and magnetometers because there isn't enough money in the local court security budget to fund security at that level. The soft underbelly of our judiciary, however, really isn't the trial courts at this point because we have at least some security. The appellate courts and the tax court have no protection at all. There's no provision for that in the existing court security statutes. So they have no perimeter security, no entrance security. They have no bailiffs in their courtroom, no screening of any kind of the individuals who come in for the hearing. And often our appellate courts and our tax court deal with very personal, very serious, very sensitive, and very emotional cases, often cases of statewide significance. Whether the termination of parental rights cases or cases like the PERS case that affect thousands and thousands of state workers, whether it's issues of gay marriage or Measure 37, sensitive land use issues, very, very sensitive cases, hot emotional button cases are presented there, and there is absolutely no security, not a single police officer, nobody to intervene if things do suddenly start to go bad. They have no budget for security. They have no funding for security. There really is no money at all in the system to take care of those kinds of issues and concerns. Since this committee got going, we've been working to try and identify a funding source for additional funds for court security, and we've made some progress with that. We've contemplated what we've talked about is looking to the county jail assessment and court security funding stream that's already in place. Of the monies in the county assessment that are taken off at the end of the payment of fines for violations, which are principally traffic fines, there's a schedule of additional amount that is tacked on to the traffic fine. And 60% of that goes to the county general fund to be used for the county jail, sheriff's department training, treatment of drug offenses, etc. And 40% goes to court security account to deal with security facilities. We haven't finalized it yet, but we're going to be asking that those numbers be bumped up a bit, not a lot, but a bit, to provide additional funding both for the counties and for court security, as well as a segregated and specific amount to go to the appellate courts to deal with their court security issues and the state court administrator's office. As a result, we're proposing that House Bill 3020 and House Bill 2792 be moved together. And we would ask you folks to appoint a work group to work on merging those and to come back with you with a joint plan with a concrete funding source, ask us to do it quickly, and ask us to come back with an agreed proposal. We're not opposed to House Bill 2792. I'm not opposed to House Bill 2792, but what I would tell you, there just isn't money in the system now to fund the needs that we already have, and those folks have needs too. They ought to be funded, but we need to identify a funding source to do that, and I think we can do that. I'm convinced we can do that. So thank you very much.
Chair Barker, I'm Scott Crampton from the State Court Administrator's Office. I'm the Director of Appellate Court Services, and Judge Lipscomb pretty much addressed all of the needs that we have, but I'd be happy to answer any specific questions you have.
Okay, great. Any questions?
Let me try and get Judge Pratt back on the line.
Perfect Court, this is Sharon.
Hi, Sharon. It's Heidi Moad calling for Judge Pratt.
Yes, hold on just
thank you. Thank you.
Hello.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Heidi Moab from the Judiciary Committee. We have, just so you know where we're at, we have heard from Judge Lipscomb of Marion County. And he has asked us to consolidate 2792 and 3020 with a work group, sort of adding input to it. So I just wanted to give you that background before we ask you to give us your testimony as well.
Okay.
So if you would go ahead and identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Yes, I am. My full name is the initial J, John Burdett Pratt. Last name Pratt. I am the presiding judge in Mount Hure County. I'm a circuit judge. I worked with Representative Butler in the proposals in Senate Bill 2792. I have no objection to to that being consolidated. Excuse me. I do want to speak to the issues related to in 2792, the purpose for the proposed amendment is to allow court security funds to be used to provide security in for justice of the peace where that's appropriate. The situation that we ran into here in Mount Hure County is that we have a justice court, which has been in existence for many years, exists in Ontario, which is in a different location from the county courthouse here in Vail. Most of our traffic offenses go through the justice court, so they actually generate a large portion of the court security funds that we have available here in Mount Hure County. The Justice Court has some security issues. In fact, not too long ago, our Justice of the Peace was assaulted by an unhappy person who appeared before him. And so the Security Committee was interested in providing some funds to make some structural changes to the Justice Court facility to provide some additional security there, and we found that we were unable to do that because the statute that provides for expenditure of security funds limits it to state courts, and by definition, the Justice of the Peace is not a state court, and so we could not use those funds to provide any security improvements at the Justice Court facility. And so what we had requested, working with Representative Butler, was an amendment to the current law that simply allows court security committees, if they deem it appropriate, to use court security funds to also provide security, or spend funds on security in justice courts. I think that explains the purpose of the bill and the background of the bill. Do you have any questions?
Any questions, committee? No, Your Honor, we don't have any questions, and thank you very much for your testimony. Judge Lipson covered the whole field just before we called you.
Okay, and I think court security is a concern for all of the courts in the state. I'm sure all of you have read and seen the various things that have happened in other jurisdictions, and we certainly don't want that to happen in Oregon.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chair, I have one question for Judge Lipscomb, and then I think we can, or actually, Mr. Cramden. One thing that I have heard from the counties, at least, is this idea in House Bill 3020 about the accounting, that the county treasurer provide a quarterly report, that's something that the counties are concerned about from a manpower and sort of resource perspective, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. We can certainly address these issues more in the work group, but I'm just curious to hear why that's in there in the fashion it is.
If it's all, Chair Barker and members of the committee, and Ms. Moad, it's in there because we have difficulty finding out what's in the court security fund now, and some counties have more difficulty than we do finding out what's in the court security. It ought not to take Freedom of Information Act request to find out what's there. They're public funds. There ought to be public accountability for what's there and where the money, what money is coming in and how it's going out. There's been, candidly, a little bit of tug of war going on between the various local court security committees and the county executives or treasurers or commissioners, whatever the situation is in the local county. Some counties have been taking out as much as 10% of those funds for administration. It's pretty clear to me that that doesn't comply with the statute, but unless they're telling us what they're doing, it's very difficult to find out where that money's going. If it's simply a matter of not having adequate funds to pay for preparation of those kinds of reports, we could, I'm sure, live with whatever reports they're already preparing for their own internal purposes. But I'd also point out that under the funding stream that we're working on and we'll be proposing, 60% of the funds 60% of the funds will be going to the county for county uses and only 40% to the courts for court security purposes. So there should be adequate funding to do a little extra accounting to let the courts and the people know what's happening to these public funds and where the money is going, whether it's being utilized for the statutory purposes or whether it's being siphoned off for other purposes.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. And also, Paul Snyder had signed up to testify, but he's willing, since this will be going to some kind of work committee, he had some objections that you're aware of, and so we'll get those worked out and come
back. Paul and I have already talked on a number of occasions. We'll continue those conversations, and I'm confident that we can work something out.
Okay. Thank you. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 3020 and 792. Thank you. Okay, next, and we're running a little bit late, but we don't want to wait another chair or second. So, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2803. Jared Broadfoot, Ron Harder, and Al Elkins in the first group. And Kevin, if you want to bring it, pull up a chair and get up there. And Ms. Moad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2803 would clarify or would redefine for the purposes of ORS 821-240 that a loaded firearm, or rather would redefine unloaded to mean that with certain types of guns that there is not a round in the chamber, for other types of guns that there is not a round of ammunition in the cylinder for the next revolution, and for a third type of gun, the muzzle-loading firearm, that muzzle-loading firearm is neither capped nor primed. Currently, the gun must be completely unloaded or else an individual is guilty or has committed the offense of operating a snowmobile or all-terrain vehicle while carrying a firearm or bow, and that is a Class B traffic violation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot with Oregon Gun Owners. This was our bill that we requested, and thank you to the Chair and also Representative Craig Smith and Senator Ferrioli for bringing this bill forward for us. The problem that we are trying to solve here is under the current statute, it does not clearly define what an unloaded firearm is, and the interpretation has been that's been enforced in the past is if you have a firearm with any ammunition, whether it be in the magazine or chamber, that it was loaded, and that's caused problems. We received phone calls from members that have possessed their revolver or semi-automatic pistol on their hip while they're recreating on their four-wheeler or snowmobile and actually got a ticket from the state police for having a loaded firearm on their ATV or snowmobile. So when we discussed this with state police during the interim, we asked the question, what was the original intent of this statute? And they said safety. So to cut down on the amount of accidents with firearms on ATVs or snowmobiles. So we went back, and our intent here is just to revise the statute and define what unloaded means. And for safety purposes, we feel that would be without a round in the chamber. Now, obviously, it's pretty easy to determine that when we get to every one of the firearms except a revolver. And we went back and forth on the issue of what does loaded mean for the definition of a revolver. And it's either going to be that you do not have a round directly underneath the hammer or on the next revolution of the cylinder. And so over a couple weeks period, we went back and forth, which should it be? And we decided on the next revolution of the cylinder. To be quite honest, we would prefer on a revolver that we not have the requirement to have an unloaded firearm. To us, it doesn't make much sense. But keeping with the intent of the original statute for safety purposes, we felt that the next revolution of the cylinder would get us there. Obviously, we can go back and forth to which one, and we may be able to decide on two cylinders, but that becomes, in a lot of cases, not practical. So that's our testimony. Obviously, for the muzzle-loading firearm, not capped or primed. Also, the safety aspect there as well. So I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have. This is just more of a definitional thing, so we can give individuals who want to possess a firearm, a snowmobile, or all-terrain vehicle clear guidance of what loaded and unloaded means.
Okay, was also part of that, this, for the state police, was the hunter. They didn't want somebody just driving up and shooting off the ATV.
Yeah, Chair Barker, also some of the concern was shooting off of an ATV or snowmobile. And in our discussions with them, obviously, when it's currently illegal to discharge a firearm while on an ATV or snowmobile. So that's already covered. And said some of those concerns, at the time frame of if you see an animal and you were to step off of an ATV and load it, that gets into issues that really are unenforceable. So,
right. Okay, thank you. Any questions? Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, here today representing the National Rifle Association. We're in support of the concept of this bill. There is no prohibition against carrying a loaded firearm on a motorcycle, on your bicycle, on a horse, the back of a pickup, or inside your vehicle. So there really should not be any reason not to do it on a snowmobile or ATV. I do have a concern, as Jared addressed, with the safety, and with the chair's permission, I've got a very short demonstration, probably talking down to a couple of people on the committee. But what I have here is a speed loader, but I got it in there backwards, and it would take the same form as the cylinder in a revolver. And what the bill suggests is that the firing pin is over a live round in the chamber. And I, when I carry only five rounds in mine, I always have the firing pin over the empty hole. This, in fact, would be unloaded, and if by some reason you dropped the piece, or if the hammer were to come back halfway, you could have an accidental discharge if it was over this live round. So I would suggest an amendment to say it be over the empty chamber and in the barrel. And with that, I conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
That'd have to be a pretty cheap revolver that didn't have a block in there, but prevent that pin from going forward. But
Mr. Chair, that's correct. But we do have
to have around. Mr. Sterrett.
Kevin Sterrett, Oregon Farmers Federation. I think Mr. Harder just addressed almost everything that I was concerned with. You people who are familiar with revolvers know that modern revolvers are rarely a safety issue, but it's almost impossible for me to imagine a circumstance under which having a round for the next cylinder would be safer. The way the bill is written doesn't seem it would be safer, because I can't imagine a situation where you could accidentally cock the hammer and have the hammer fall. So it would make more sense to have the empty round be the one under the chamber. It would also allow people who were carrying revolvers for self-defense to get that gun into action immediately without any of the safety concerns.
We amended that on the fly here.
No.
Okay. Okay. Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you. We'll go ahead and I'll have Heidi draft amendment on that, and we'll amend it to empty hammer over an empty cylinder on a revolver.
Thank you.
And we'll bring it back for a work session. Yeah. Any further business before the committee today? Adjourned.